Hello. In this audio snippet, we're going to continue talking about the ninth pillar of the new American Constitution, which would be the fourth individual human right, which is the right to a fair reputation. And hopefully we'll finish that talking about that pillar in this snippet so that we can then move on to the 10th and final pillar, which is probably the most complex pillar of them all in a sense. But we'll hopefully get to that pillar in the next audio snippet. So, continuing with the ninth pillar, we mentioned that the right to a fair reputation basically has certain characteristics that must be taken into account when it's being attacked. In other words, when your right to a fair reputation is being attacked, usually that attack takes on certain forms or has certain characteristics. And we mentioned that one of the main characteristics that generally accompanies an attack on your fair reputation is what we can call surface accusations. In other words, where people take what you have said or what you have done, maybe in public, and in a sense, they are saying what you did say, correctly quoting you in a sense, or correctly saying what you actually did in public, but then taking whatever you said or did and giving it a twisted meaning without understanding the spirit of what was being said. Just to give you an example, we mentioned a few examples in the previous snippet, if I remember correctly. But just to give you another example, during the 2008 election, presidential election here in the U.S., there was Sarah Palin and John McCain going against the bastard and Bite Me. And I remember that during that campaign, Sarah Palin was hated, who was hated by the left, was constantly attacked and vilified for any reason that they could find because they wanted to destroy her. And I remember that at one point she said something about politicians being in the crosshairs, like the Democrats being in the crosshairs that they would be defeated, that she had her eyes on them and had them in her crosshairs. And they took that out of context and tried to indicate that she was promoting violence or assassinations against Democrats, which is totally ridiculous because in the history of American politics and American debate, that phrase crosshairs or that term crosshairs is it has been used constantly by people, and everybody knows that that you're talking figuratively about targeting someone and making them pay for something that they did wrong in one way or another, but making them pay in a sense of justice, not in the sense of mob lynching or mob revenge. So everybody who listened to her saying those things in the context of the speech, in the context of the moment, knew what she was talking about. No one in their right minds thought about her suggesting that people go out and kill Democrats, that they take literal rifles and put Democrats in their literal crosshairs and then pull on a literal trigger to kill a literal Democrat. No one was saying, she was not saying that, but so they took words that were literal, and yes, she did say crosshairs, but they took it out of context, took the spirit, disconnected the spirit of what was being said from the words. And then they were, once you disconnect the spirit from the words, then the words can be twisted around to mean anything you want. And that's one of the characteristics of an attack on your fair reputation that people generally do what we're calling surface accusations. They take something from the surface and then disconnect it from the spirit of the original context of your words and what you were trying to say, and then turn the words against you in a distorted way to destroy your reputation. And the second quality that you will generally see in an attack on that right to a fair reputation, that ninth pillar, that fourth human right, is that the attack has this quality of being systematic. And usually it's not necessarily people get together in this smoke-filled room and behind closed doors and plot to destroy you. A lot of times that's exactly what they do. But in other cases, it's almost, how can we say it? It's almost systematic without the explicit planning or deliberate planning. It's as if people who have like minds start thinking the same way, and they realize, okay, we have to destroy someone, and as part of our destruction of that person, we have to make their lives completely miserable and block them in every way, destroy their reputations, destroy their families, make it so that they can't move forward. And because of that, it's as if everybody gets into an agreement without actually talking to each other. And that usually happens when people have been indoctrinated for a long time. So people get taught the same rubbish over and over again, which is what happens so much in our public school system here in America, that people get these horrible ideas fed into their heads. And once those ideas are there, that those ideas drive all their actions. So it seems like sometimes they are coordinated, but it's actually not that they're actually planning and strategizing together. It's just that they are all children of the same wrong teaching, the same wrong ideology. And because of that, they start acting in a certain way. They know that they've been fed this idea that you have to destroy whoever is against the ideology. You have to slander them, libel against them, do whatever it takes to take them down. So they start coordinating, and then they kind of learn from each other. When they see someone else who is of a similar ideology doing something, attacking a person a certain way, they go, oh, I can do that too. And then they start attacking, and it becomes systematic. They learn from each other. There's a lot of a teaching element, teacherly quality, shall we say, about the whole thing, where they become systematic, and it's also a herd mentality. It's very pastoral in that sense as well, where people get into this herd mentality where they all, like little sheep, start acting exactly the same way, and they systematically go after certain people who are not to their liking, who are not compatible with their ideology, and not just incompatible, they are perceived as a threat to their ideology, so they feel the need to fight back by whatever means necessary. And that's when the systematic attack on a person's fair reputation usually starts to intensify. And a third quality we mentioned before was these attacks on your fair reputation have this intent to punish and neutralize. And last time we talked about what is, most of the time, you could say at the core of the attack on your fair reputation. People tend to attack your reputation because they want to discredit your judgments. So you're saying something that is making them very uncomfortable, or that is putting into question their ideology, their thinking, their sacred cows, things that they hold dear. And because of that, they need to punish you, to neutralize you, to destroy you in some way, so that once your credibility has been destroyed, no one will pay attention to you. I remember, for example, just to give you an idea, when I was younger, and I'll say younger just to feel better about myself, but when I was younger, I remember that I would occasionally hear about this fellow called Rush Limbaugh. And I don't know where I got the idea, but for some reason, I began to think of him as this radical nut job. And I don't know why, but it was subtly fed to me from different sources. And I truly don't recall how it happened, but I became convinced that he was... he was not right in his head, for some reason. And then one thing led to another in my life, and I ended up having to live with a relative who was a fan of Rush Limbaugh. And he would start listening to his radio show that would come on at noon Eastern time, here on the Eastern Seaboard. And then I was kind of like forced, in a sense, to listen to him. And when I started listening to him, I said, my goodness, this guy makes a lot of sense, to the point that I actually became a big fan. Then I eventually, by 2016, I became disappointed with him because he kind of took a wrong turn. He began to show signs of not being correct. On the correct path in certain aspects, but I did listen to him for many years, probably for 7 years, when I would basically listen to him every day while at work. He almost like became a friend, the sort of friend that you know is going to start talking to you at 12, from 12 to 3 p.m. Every day. And what I'm trying to get across here is that people who hated him, who hated what he had to say, who hated he sometimes said some things that I felt were very stupid or very nonsensical. But most of the time, he would say things that were right on, and he would give it like an interesting twist or an interesting explanation where you go, oh, I hadn't seen it that way. And sometimes he just, sounded brilliant in the way he argued things and pointed them out. And because he was being so brilliant at how he attacked the left started hating him and said, oh, we do not want these judgments coming against us, so we are going to fight back. And we're going to label him this, label him that. So they started in a subtle way kind of attacking his reputation, to the point that even I, when I was a younger person, was catching these vibes, these vibrations about Rush Limbaugh, and formed an image of him that, in a sense, blocked my access to him. So he had no access to me because I had a perception of him that was formed by the bad... by the slander, you could say, of people against him, this collective, silent, subtle slander against him. And that prevented me being exposed to his judgments, in a sense, so because his credibility had been destroyed in my mind. And it was until I was, in a sense, forced or put in a situation where I was compelled to listen to him, that I realized, oh my goodness, this guy is making a lot of sense. He's not at all what I had been indoctrinated subtly into thinking that he was. And that's why this third quality about the intent to punish and neutralize is so important. When you see that quality coming, of those attacks coming in, then you know, hey, my fair reputation is being attacked and there's an attempt to neutralize me, because I'm a danger. My judgments are dangerous, so they want to punish me. There's a certain punitive nature to the situation, and an effort to neutralize you. A fourth quality that we mentioned before was the fact that when these attacks come against you, they usually have this air of objectivity. In other words, it's people who come not as spokespeople, not as, how can we say it, people who come to promote an idea or a point of view. It's people who come mostly as witnesses, as reporters, who objectively are simply describing what's going on, what they saw, or what they heard, when in fact they have an agenda behind them. But they put on this clothing or disguise of objectivity. And so they are actually giving opinion, but they are cloaking it or disguising it as statement of fact. And you see that a lot in newscasts, in the media here in the U.S. A great deal, and throughout a great portion of the world, where these newscasters come on and they act like they are Walter Cronkite, saying all these things objectively, when in fact they are seeing everything through these very biased glasses, where they are very keen on blocking any information that goes against their ideology. So if any piece of news comes along that doesn't fit their agenda, their ideology, they act like that news never happened, and you never get to hear it on their broadcast. But if something kind of fits their agenda, they take it and they exaggerate it. So they take surface truths again, and they twist them, and they explode them and exaggerate them to promote their agenda. And as you're watching, you said, "Oh, I just listened to the 11 o'clock news." So you think that you just listened to a regular, objective broadcast talking about the news events of the day, which used to be the case 30, 40 years ago. I remember when I was a young kid, you had a greater chance of listening to just news, just regular news, when you were listening to a newscast. Sometimes it was difficult to make out whether the person was, Republican or Democrat or right, leaning right or leaning left, because he or she was just telling you the news. But nowadays, that has all changed. The indoctrination has been so strong over these years that we have gotten to the point where we have all these so-called newscasters and journalists, quote-unquote, who are, put on this cloak of objective journalist, but they're actually just promoting ideology, spewing out ideology, controlling what you can hear, what you will hear, what you will not hear, all in the interest of promoting their agenda, and that's how they destroy people. They destroy people's reputation by selectively picking whatever destroys the people that they don't like, but they portray it as if they are just giving you the news. So there's this pretension of objectivity. So when we're talking about all of this, we have to remember we have the right to give an opinion. If I call Joe Bite Me a worthless son of a bitch, which he is, a little lying bastard, a thief who stole the election, I'm expressing an opinion, but it's an opinion based on actual reality. But if someone says, "Oh, you're slandering him," well, I am not coming here as a newscaster. I am not cloaking myself as this objective journalist was just stating what he saw, and letting you form your own opinion. I'm stating an opinion which is based on a reality, and we have to, as we're saying all of this, we have to be very clear. Reality exists outside of us. We cannot shape reality. Reality is to shape us. We are to be shaped by reality, by the truth. We don't shape the truth. The truth should shape us. So the truth is out there. Whether I say it or don't say it, Joe, son of a bitch, bite me. That little senile bastard who is pooping his pants and shuffling his feet across the White House every day, that worthless little bastard boy, stole the election of 2020. That is a fact. Now, the problem is that reality, which is out there, is sometimes not perceived by everybody. So something can be true, but some people have a hard time seeing it and others don't. So when we're talking about opinion, we're not saying, oh, okay, anybody can say anything because reality, there's no objective truth. No, it's that when we analyze what someone said, we have to take into account that some things are not as clear as other things. So, for example, if I say 2 plus 2 equals 5, that is clearly wrong. There is no difficulty in disproving that, unless, obviously, if you change the definition of what the plus sign means, because at the end of the day, an addition is just a mathematical construct. It's a definition. So you defined it so that 2 plus 2 equals 4. But if you change what addition means, then it becomes something else. It could be something, some other value. But under the normal traditional definition, we know that 2 plus 2 is 4, and there is no... it's very easy for all of us to see that reality. But if we mention what I just said a moment ago, that son of a bitch, Joe Bite Me, stole the election and is a liar and a thief, that is a reality. That is beyond question. In the world of reality, that's exactly what it is. But some people have a harder time seeing it than others. So that's where the opinion spectrum starts to manifest itself. And you have to understand that some people have one opinion, another person has another opinion. But if I'm a journalist, as an objective reporter of the news, what I have to say is not, Joe Bite Me is a worthless son of a bitch, or, you know, as some liberals would say, Trump is a racist, or hinting these things. Instead, all I have to do is report the information. Okay, there were these ladies in Atlanta who were taking ballots out of suitcases when the observers were kicked out of the room, and they started taking these ballots and started running them through the scanner or whatever it's called, like twice or three times. And it's on tape. I, as a reporter, have the responsibility to share that information, and then you decide if Joe Bite Me is a thief. And then you can debate whether or not we are misunderstanding what those black ladies were doing in Atlanta when they were counting all these ballots. Why were these ballots in a suitcase? Why were they running them through this the machine multiple times? Why did they do it when the observers were out? Wasn't that a violation of Atlanta law? Well, you can probably, if you're a naive fool, then you can probably find a million explanations to justify it, so that in your head you can justify your misguided belief. But the reality is there. So that's one thing that's very important when deciding, okay, is this person attacking my reputation, and should he or she be punished for doing so? It depends on the level of opinion versus claim of objective witnessing. So if they're acting like pretending to be witnesses, but they're giving false opinion, then they have to be attacked back for having attacked your right to a fair reputation. But if they're giving an opinion, then that's where, you know, the freedom of speech, First Amendment rights come in, and the right to life, the sixth pillar, the first fundamental human right. Where, yeah, I mean, I if someone can say that that Joe Biden is the most wonderful person on the face of the earth, which obviously would be a lie. He's a liar, a thief, a pedophile, a manipulator. And when I say pedophile, I mean it in the sense that he likes to grope young children. And it's been shown over and over again in these videos. He sniffs women's hair. It's been shown in videos over and over again. So there's something wrong with that man. So, but if you want to think that he's the most wonderful man in the world, that's your right to do so. But you have to state it as an opinion, or it has to be clear that it's an opinion. If you come as a journalist and pretend like you are objectively declaring this, then there is a problem. So so that's point number four that we wanted to mention about attacks on the fair reputation of an individual. And the fifth thing that we'd like to mention about these sorts of attacks is that they are usually associated to false stereotypes. So there's a false stereotype, and that false stereotype causes the slander or the libel to be true in the slanderer's mind. So, for example, amongst liberals, for some reason that that is to blame on the side of conservatives a great deal, is that their liberals believe that conservatives are, especially if they're white, are racists, and it goes to the extreme that if they listen to a black conservative, saying things that sound conservative to the liberal, the black conservative is a racist. So their mind is so warped and so convinced, that's like a stake that has been just drilled into the ground so deep that it becomes almost immovable in their minds. So the world revolves around this fundamental truth: all conservatives are racists. So that's the stereotype. And once that stereotype goes into the ground, then everything that they perceive in the world around them is judged by that standard. So if a Republican criticizes, or a conservative criticizes, a black person for having done something wrong, oh, there we go, he's a racist. Even if the criticism is valid, even if the criticism has nothing to do with the guy being black, it's just that he criticized a black man, oh yeah, that proves the stereotype. So they go and start reporting to other people, this guy's a racist because he criticized a black person. And to them, it's like witnessing, like saying, something valid about that guy's reputation. So they're destroying the reputation based on a false stereotype. So even if there's no intentionality, it's like they don't mean to destroy the reputation. Yeah, they do want, in their hearts, they want to kill that person. They want to just kill that conservative and destroy him and wipe him off the face of the earth. But they feel that they're doing it as these warriors for justice, these Don Quixotes fighting all these windmills of injustice and racism and climate change and all these things. And everything revolves around that, but that does not take away from them incorrectly destroying your reputation. So if they are saying something that's not true, they should be punished, even if they sincerely think the rubbish that they are saying, even if they sincerely think that they are being witnesses. So that's very important to remember, that these people are speaking falsehoods based on false stereotypes. And that's one thing to kind of analyze when you're discerning whether your right to a fair reputation is being attacked, whether the person who's speaking is holding on to false stereotypes that are driving the attack. And the reason why we're saying these five things: surface accusation, systematic attack, intent to punish and neutralize, pretending objectivity and false stereotypes is that these are parameters that can be placed in the or laid out in the new American Constitution so that judges, when they come up against cases of of libel or slander, they can go through these and go, okay, do I see these things being manifested in this alleged attack on the person's fair reputation? So there are parameters to judge these attacks. And as you can see, we're talking about the right to a fair reputation from a different perspective than the perspective that is in the current legal system in America, and I dare say throughout most of the world. Because nowadays, as we all more or less saw a little bit in the previous audio snippet, libel or slander is always seen as this thing that is in constant conflict with the First Amendment. And for those who are not in America, when people say the First Amendment rights, they're usually talking about like the right to free speech, which is one of the rights that is listed in the First Amendment of the current Constitution, which, as we've said before, is part of a broader right, the right to life. And that broader right to life is what we need to define in the New American Constitution to have the right to free speech as a sub-right under that major right. But the thing is that in our current system, that's how we see it, libel versus First Amendment rights. In other words, people should have the right to say what they feel or what they believe, freedom of speech, First Amendment rights. And then how much do we allow them to speak before we start calling it libel? So they see it as a contrast between the First Amendment and your right to libel or slander another person. But and there's an element of that. But as I hope you've seen, we are defining it almost the other way around. Because usually the slander comes because someone was exercising their First Amendment right. As we said before in the previous audio clip, there's this fellow named Mike Lindell who owns or started a company called MyPillow here in the U.S. in Minnesota. And he's been very successful in everything. And because he began to speak out about the 2020 stolen election, he's been vilified and attacked, and the bank that he has that his company does business with gave him an ultimatum: you have 30 days. We're going to close all your accounts. We don't want anything to do with you. And when they were confronted about it, they said, we're concerned about our reputation. Because if we are holding his money, then we will be criticized for what he is doing. A bank is a bank is a bank. That's what it's supposed to do. It's not supposed to be making social comments or social decisions about things. It's just a bank, but they're getting into that business of deciding. Okay, we're going to be these social justice warriors, and we're concerned about our reputation. So at the end of the day, it was an issue of fair reputation. But in this case, it was them attacking the reputation of Mike Lindell, saying, you are an evil person, you are a monster, and that's why we don't want your money in our bank. And why were they doing that? That bank and all these other people have attacked Mike Lindell and tried to smear his reputation because he exercised his First Amendment right. So you can see that when we start analyzing the right to a fair reputation from a cleaner perspective, like let's wipe the slate and think about it in a metaphysical way, then it becomes obvious that it's not exactly how we are understanding it. It's a fundamental human right that usually gets attacked because we have been exercising our right to make judgments, to say this is right, this is wrong, this guy is right, this guy is wrong. And we start angering the wrong people, quote-unquote, and these people start attacking your reputation because they want to destroy your credibility. especially if your judgments are right on the spot, if you're hitting raw nerves every time you say things because you're saying exactly what needs to be said in a way that cannot be refuted, then they say, we have to kill this guy. We have to destroy this guy. We have to discredit him, neutralize him, so that no one will pay attention to him anymore. So they start looking for a way to discredit you. And so it's actually, in a deeper sense, the right to a fair reputation becomes important because you're exercising your First Amendment right. It's not that you have to choose between the right to a fair reputation and the right to free speech. It's actually because you're exercising your right to free speech that your other right to a fair reputation needs to be protected. I hope that makes sense. And another thing is that currently, because we kind of let this right develop legally in our system from a more pragmatic standpoint instead of thinking of it metaphysically, then we have turned it into something that's directed at the big people. Libel or slander is usually perceived as something that is directed at the big people by the little people. In other words, someone slandering a politician or an actor or this well-known figure, because we're saying, okay, this person, there's no point in worrying about a person's reputation unless the person has a certain fame attached to him or her. And so we see it as the little people saying things against the big people. And then we get into this, underdog mentality where we go, no, the little people have a right to question the big people and to criticize them. So we have to be careful not to be too protective of the big guy's reputation, because he's a big guy. He should be able to take it. And the little guy should have the freedom to speak out against the big guy. But ironically, in most cases, when the right to a fair reputation needs to be addressed or taken into account, is when the opposite is happening. It's when the big people are attacking the little people. See, like for example, we were saying that on Twitter, for example, or Facebook, if you say something that doesn't fit these big companies' political ideologies, and that's the sad thing. I mean, why the hell should it matter what Jack Dorsey or Mark Zuckerturd have to say or think about any political issues when you're using their websites? Twitter was intended to be a place where you share quick thoughts. You know, 140 characters at the beginning or less. And that's all it was, a channel of communicating short messages to other people. That's all it was. It wasn't designed to be the mouthpiece of the Democrat Party or of liberalism or anything like that. And Facebook has a more sordid internal origin. Facebook is corrupt from the start, as opposed to Twitter, which had kind of like a raison d'être, metaphysically speaking, and then got corrupted. Same as Google. Facebook is more like inherently born corrupted. But even if you justify its existence, you have to say it's supposed to be just a place where you post pictures and talk to your friends and stuff. Whatever Facebook's executives think about politics should be irrelevant to the execution of, you know, of or your usage of the website. But these people have decided that, no, we are going to determine public opinion. We're going to control it. So the little people, if they post something that is contrary to these people's ideology, if that happens, these big people start attacking them, and they close their accounts or kind of freeze their accounts. And then any friend who tries to access their account, sees this message saying, oh, this account has been temporarily closed or whatever, or suspended because of this tweet or this post that was against our guidelines and was misinformation and blah, blah, blah. So you're seeing that the little people are the ones who are being slandered. You are a misinformer. You're a liar. You're a racist. You said something racist the other day, and that's why we're shutting you down. So, and when most of the vast majority of the time, whatever is being said is really not at all what it doesn't at all match the accusation. What was posted is completely different from the accusation. But you get labeled like that, and everybody who sees that comment from Facebook, from Twitter, or you know, or from other companies, they see the comment against you. They go, "Oh, he must be a racist." We have to see that the right to a fair reputation usually is perceived as, you know, the little people slandering the big people. But it's usually the other way around. The big people are trying to silence the little people, the people with power. Because a person, the right to a fair reputation is more easily attacked when you have power to attack it. So if you're a big person, it's easier for you to destroy the reputation of a little person than the other way around. And that's something that has not been made clear in the American legal system, because we've kind of seen it from the wrong perspective. Another thing that has more or less developed inadvertently, because we have tried to understand or incorporate this right into our legal system in a pragmatic way, is that libel and slander have become more or less a fair game against public figures. Because with public figures, there's a higher burden of proof. In other words, in the American legal system, they classify the plaintiff, you know, whoever is suing for defamation in one of three categories. Public figure, I think it's someone who is temporarily public figure, and a private figure or private individual or private person. A public figure is someone, you know, that everybody knows about, Trump or, you know, some actor, Johnny Depp or whoever. Those are publicly known figures. Then temporarily public are people who are otherwise private, who somehow get injected into a very public circumstance, and then they become publicly known within a limited scope for a particular season of time. And then they kind of fade away after their 15 minutes of the spotlight being on them, and they become private again. And then the third category is just a purely private individual. So we have had to artificially split people into that, depending on who is doing the accusation of slander. And because we want to allow the little people to continue slandering the big people, or giving them freedom of speech to say whatever they want, then we have said in the American legal system that the public figures and temporarily public figures, if they're suing, they have to prove intent. I apologize, I don't remember the exact legal term for that. They have to prove that there was a malice, deliberate malice in the slander, in order to have punitive damages. So, and if you're a private person, you just have to prove negligence. Like, this newspaper published something about me, but they were negligent with the facts and made me look bad. But you don't have to prove that the newspaper was coming after you to destroy you, or that there was any malice, why? And the question is, why is that relevant? I mean, it's for example, the way I see it is, the right to a fair reputation is like someone trying to stab you in the back. It's kind of tantamount to that in many ways. So if the right to fear, if someone is stabbing you, and you're a public figure, does it hurt less than if you're, you know, being stabbed and you're a private figure? Why? I mean, you're still being stabbed. So we should judge the stabbing on the merits of the stabbing alone, not on the notoriety of the person being stabbed. And I know that this is a right about a fair reputation, so the person's notoriety or reputation prior to the stabbing, in a sense, you could say could play a role. But when the more you think about it, is, I mean, if I said something slanderous against you and you're a private person and I called you all sorts of names, why should I be punished less than if you are a famous person or are punished more than if you're a famous person and I'm spewing out the same rubbish? Why would your fame affect how much I try to destroy you as an individual? There is a certain something wrong with that. And that's one thing that would be stricken from the New American Constitution, where we have to, we would emphasize, no, you punish a person for slandering someone else on the merit of the slander per se, just because you know that destroyed the reputation of the person with five people as opposed to 500. Maybe should affect in some ways in terms of your punitive damages, but it kind of insinuates that that you are worth more or worth less depending on how many people follow you, and it shouldn't be like that. Another problem with the current way that libel or slander is handled in the American system is that it requires proof of damages. So in other words, not only do I have to prove if I'm a plaintiff, not only do I have to prove that you slandered me, I also have to prove how much damage it caused, your slander caused me. Like, oh, I lost business, and I lost friends, or I lost this, that, and the other. But, so in other words, that is what they're implying with that, is that, let's say that you slander me, and I have a whole bunch of flimsy friends, you know, like fair weather friends, and once they hear you slander me, they believe the slander and leave me all to myself. Or, you know, I'm in a town where everybody's a just bunch of morons, liberal morons. They listen, they hear some smearing campaign against me, and they stop patronizing my business, and I have great financial difficulty. Okay, so they did a great damage to me. But now let's say another scenario where I have a whole bunch of loyal friends, friends with common sense, who think for themselves, who are not easily moved by rumors or innuendos, and who listen to you slander me, and decide to stick with me and say, yes, no, that I don't believe that because I know him and I know that what that person said is not true. He didn't say that, or he said that, but he didn't mean that. I was there, this and that and the other. And they stand by you, and let's say the business that I'm running is not affected because my customers are all intelligent people who know that that is just pure nonsense that's being spewed against me. And the insinuation is that because I have better friends, because I live in a better city with more intelligent, less idiotic, less you know, in other words, less liberal people, then your slander, vile and vitriolic as it was, deserves less punishment. You know, it's like somebody saying, okay, if I shoot you and you have a vest, you know, bulletproof vest, and I shoot you 6-7 times with this high-powered weapon, but I can't quite kill you because you're wearing a bulletproof vest, then my sentence should be less than if you were not wearing a bulletproof vest. You know, I'm doing the exact same thing. I don't even know whether you have a bulletproof vest, and I'm shooting at you to kill you because I hate your guts, and I hate what you're saying, and I hate your judgments, and you shoot to kill. And then, oh, he had a bulletproof vest on. Oh, And let's say that you know, you the other person is badly damaged, but they survive, and you're telling me, hey, then, you know, it's not that bad. You know, if he survived, you're okay. You know, go shoot someone else. That doesn't make sense. What you see is the person had the intent to kill you. He wanted to destroy your life. And whether you have a bulletproof vest is, you know, it's just a benefit to you. It shouldn't be a benefit to him. So I hope that makes sense. And that's a problem that that's embedded in how we treat libel and slander and should not be there. And having said all this, my intent was that in this audio snippet, we were going to go through some details. And I think it might not be a good idea to do it at this time, just to go through the history of American libel and slander laws, in a sense, a very brief history, very quickly, just to get an idea, because the intent is to show you how flimsily defined it is and how shaky and worrisome it is. When you read the history of how the concept of the right to a fair reputation has developed in the legal system, you go, my goodness, this is worrisome. And it just shows you how bad the system is, how bad the constitutional system left by the founding fathers really is. And as we said at the beginning, the right to a fair reputation is not in the Constitution. It's not there at all. Because the founding fathers were not thinking about drafting a document that delineated the rights of the individual. They were drafting a document to hold a whole bunch of whiny teenage states together. They had the Articles of Confederation, which was too weak to hold the nation together, so they got together to form a stronger document that tried to keep these bratty teenage states together as a nation. And that's all they cared for. And once they were able to achieve that, they stopped and said, we don't need to think anymore. And even as they started facing problems, if you look at Marbury versus Madison, which we'll talk about maybe hopefully in some future audio clip, while the founding fathers were still alive, because, you know, Madison is in the name of that famous case, and Madison is, you know, James Madison, the main writer of the U.S. Constitution, one of the founding fathers. I mean, if there's anyone of all the people out there that you could call a founding father, if there's one that you would say, if you had to just pick one as the founding father of the nation, it has to be James Madison, without a doubt. People say George Washington. No, forget George Washington. The real founding father of this nation is, at the end of the day, I mean, they all participated, don't get me wrong, including George Washington, but if you have to pick one, you know, there's a gun to your head, you have to pick one and just one, it has to be Jimmy Mad. And he was around, and Marbury versus Madison came along, and it kind of proved, hey, we don't know what we're doing here. You know, we didn't really define all these things that need to be defined and clarified. No. It was like a shock to the system, and no one reacted. They just did enough to get around the problem and keep going, you know, like a runner. You know, they stumbled and they almost fall, and they just, you know, try to regain their trot and keep going. That's what we've been doing constantly, instead of stopping and saying, hey, there's something wrong with the way we're running. And could it be that I'm carrying all, you know, why am I carrying this 50-pound backpack? I don't need this backpack. Maybe I should take it off. But no. We just keep going with the backpack on. Every now and then we kind of lighten the load of the backpack and keep going. But we start putting rocks and other stuff in the backpack as we go along. And we never stop to say, hey, we're doing something fundamentally wrong. And that's what you start seeing as you see the history of the right to a fair reputation. And I hope it's become clear that it is a right. And you can't define it in terms of the other rights, the right to life or right to property, because someone might argue, well, you don't have to define that as a separate right, because you can say that if your fair reputation is being attacked, for example, and you're a business owner, then you will lose business. So your right to property is being questioned. Or, for example, if I'm a worker and I get a bad reputation and I can't get a job anymore, so I'm going to starve to death. And in other words, my right to life is being violated. Then you could say, oh, well, then that's the real right that's being violated. And the answer is no. Those are consequences. Those are like secondary consequences of another right being violated, the right to a fair reputation. And even if they don't touch you, even if that attack doesn't cause you any loss of life, any loss of property, or any loss of privacy, for example, like if someone gets slandered, then you always have these journalists, you know, gathering around the person who's being slandered to ask them, is this true and all that, so your privacy starts getting attacked. But even if your privacy doesn't get attacked, or your right to life is not attacked, or your right to properties not being attacked, there's some other attack that's going on that has to be addressed. There's a fundamental right, there's a violation that happened when you're unfairly slandered, or your reputation is unfairly attacked, especially if it's only because you said something that touched the raw nerve, which is usually the root cause of that right being violated. So I thought we would have time to go through that in this audio snippet, but clearly I spoke, and we've run out of time again. So we'll have to continue this in the next audio snippet, and then we'll move on to the 10th pillar, which I would dare say is the pillar that worries me the most, because it's very complicated to explain. And I think that if we as a nation can get the 10th pillar right, if we can get that one pillar defined properly and put it into the new American Constitution, I can tell you we are kind of set. We'll be set for life, because that's probably the most difficult pillar to define. But it's also, if we can define it, it can actually serve as a fortress to protect the other pillars, the other four rights. So we'll get to that some future snippet, and then we'll move on to talk about other things. After talking about the 10 pillars, our intent will be to also talk about how to reshape the political system. We've briefly talked about how we are to define a new House of Commons, a unicameral house, a legislative house, and how that house will be partyless. We've gone into detail about that, but then we'll start talking about how the election process needs to be redefined, and not just in terms of putting in parameters to hold off a fraud like what happened in 2020 and what the Democrats will likely do in 2022, like what happened here in New Jersey. That son of a bitch, worthless little Irish bastard Murphy, stole the election from another guy who won, and they did it through the mail-in ballots, which has become the root cause of why all these lockdowns and everything started, because it was a way to justify these mail-in ballots. And once you institute the mail-in balloting system, then you have basically deprived the whole system of its integrity, because then, you know, there is no one person, one vote. Then it's, you know, five sheets of paper, five votes. It's not one person, one vote. It's how many sheets of paper you can put together and stuff into the system. It's much easier than stuffing one person into the system. You have to do more of an effort to commit fraud when it's one person, when it's in-person voting. And on a side note, I get angry when I see these stories, these headlines about how conservatives are so angry at liberals because they're trying to, quote, federalize the election system with this HR1 bill that's has been in the news here at the time of this recording here in America. And the problem with that bill is not that they're trying to federalize the voting system, is that they're trying to put corrupt federal laws on top of the already corrupt state laws, because the founding fathers, like good old idiots, decided that every state could decide that how elections are held in their by their own rules, and no one can tell them constitutionally. No one can tell them how to run their elections, so they can do run roughshod over. The rest of the country by allowing corruption inside their own borders. And that's why we had to put in the 14th and 15th Amendments to kind of hold that off a little bit. But that wasn't enough. We haven't really taken control of the corruption at the state level. So the corruption at the state level is being left intact. The federalism is being left intact. It's just that another layer of additional corruption laws are being instituted from above as an umbrella on top of the local corruption. So it's not federalizing the law. It's just adding federal corruption to the state corruption, which is a completely different thing. And I get so angry at how stupid conservatives are. They don't just still don't get it. Federalism is what caused the election to be stolen. If we had had a federal system of controls, we could have controlled the whole thing from the beginning and established a system where we can control corruption more easily than to have these backdoor corruptions that happen at every state. So I get angry that and so disappointed that Americans still don't get it. It's like I live in a nation of morons, a nation of idiots. We've gone through 2 years of all this disaster, and we still don't get it. Liberals are still lost and hopefully dying off with those rape by injections that they so willingly take, and hopefully a lot of them will be wiped out over the next 5 years. And I'm longing to see them die off. I want them dead. On the right side, you have the conservatives who are still trapped in their founding father worship, who still don't understand why things have been going so wrong. They've been acting so self-centeredly and so enclosed in their traditions and their limited understanding of the truth that's why they have allowed the liberals to run roughshod and just go around indoctrinating, because the real swamp is the conservative movement. They are the party, they are the movement of stagnation, of limitation, of never doing anything new, just staying in the old and the old, even if it doesn't work, even if it's flawed and corrupt, metaphysically unsound. And they still don't get it. It's like I'm living in a country of idiots. And a few get a few ideas, but then I listen long enough and eventually I go, no, he didn't get it. Or she didn't get it. No, they don't get it. And it's very frustrating, very disappointing. But something has to happen over the next 2 years, hopefully, that will cause something to awaken us from this collective stupidity that we're in this country and in some ways around the world. The problem is America right now. America does not wake up, and I don't know how long we will continue in this madness. We just have to continue laying out these principles so that hopefully someone will pick them up and write them down, and we'll start anew with these principles. This is the salvation of America from a political and social perspective. And the principles that we're laying out here go beyond the political. And if you think that I've been talking politics, then I'm sorry to say it, pardon my friends, you're a fool. You don't get what I've been saying. And if you think that these are just political comments that are limited to the political, then you don't get it. Because we're talking about things that are so much deeper than what is being said on the surface. What we're saying here is a prototype of things that are relevant at a much deeper level of American society and the life of the human being. And but I can't go into the details of that because either you get it or you don't. And I have been instructed not to say anything beyond what I have to say about the political realm. And it will be up to you to understand how it transcends the political realm at ways that are so fantastic you either get it or you don't, because I cannot convey it to you with words. And these snippets are a test for you to see to test you as to whether you can see beyond what is in front of you and see what is behind the curtain and behind the scenes in regards to the truth. So thank you, and we'll continue in the next snippet. Thank you very much.